1st, we count on satellites in various orbits for communication, GPS, weather forecasting, scientific research, and a lot more. And military and intelligence services around the world have a lot at stake in Earth's orbit, too. Satellites are really vulnerable, and the international agreements that manage conflict in space are old and very, very limited. That has some experts worried that a small provocation in orbit could lead to a much bigger conflict. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on satellites for your work, for example? Do you have questions about how Earth's orbit is being divided up, filled up in many cases, and how a possible conflict could play out in space? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Reeder wrote about orbital conflict in the new cover story at Harper's Magazine, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get to the potential for conflict in orbit, can you set the stakes for us a little bit? I gave a quick list there of how we count on satellites. How much, especially in the United States, do we rely on the existence of lots and lots of satellites?
Sure. It's a really, they really underpin so many different parts of daily life. You know, weather, navigation, communications, broadcasting, they're a huge piece of infrastructure for civilian life, and they really also are hugely important for the military that relies on them for, you know, everything from communications to nuclear command and control. They're really, I think most of us take them for granted and don't think much about them, but we are all using them all the time.
For conflict on land and sea and in the air, there's a lot of international law and military protocols and things like that. You write that there's really not much of that in place for space, and what there is really old and out of date. What kind of international anything governs space conflict?
Right. The main piece of international law that governs conflict in space is the Outer Space Treaty, which is from 1967. So it was written when there were only a few satellites in orbit. No one had been to the moon. It's just really written from a different time. And it has a lot of provisions that lay the groundwork for how militaries are able to operate in space. It prohibits the use of weapons of mass destruction. It prohibits the establishment of a military base on the moon or other celestial bodies. But it doesn't speak to a lot of the more contemporary technologies, or like the issue of crowding was simply not on anyone's mind in 1967.
How crowded is it getting up there?
Very crowded. I mean, it's interesting because space is obviously enormous. There's plenty of space in space. But the most useful parts of space are a couple of orbital belts, low Earth orbit and geostationary orbit that's further away. And so the most useful sort of tracks around the planet are getting crowded. They're getting so crowded that there's an office in the U.S. military that tracks all the satellites that are orbiting the Earth and keeps track of their trajectories and issues warnings to the satellite operators when it sees that two satellites are on a course to come very close to each other. And that agency is now issuing thousands of those warnings every day. Even though actual collisions are extremely, extremely rare, there are more close calls now.
When we think of militarized satellites and threats to satellites, it may sound like science fiction. And yeah, maybe someday in the future, this is a problem. As you write, no, this is happening now. What kind of things are going on over our heads here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it does sound a lot like science fiction. But there are satellites that are used by the military to, you know, for reconnaissance, those are sort of well established. There have been several tests of anti-satellite weapons that cause a lot of debris. And so those, China has successfully tested an anti-satellite weapon. The US has also. Those are very rare. There's a sort of deterrence built in because when something is hit in space, it creates this cloud of debris that then makes it difficult for satellite operators to maneuver. It creates this cloud of very high speed junk. So there are those deterrents that are built in, but those weapons that can target satellites physically have been tested. And what people are really concerned about now is a sort of new generation of sort of subtler weapons that aren't, it's not a physical weapon like a projectile being aimed at a satellite, but things like a laser that could be aimed at a satellite and disable its optics, or the use of microwaves or chemical sprays that could disable different features of satellites. And those are sort of, they're less, you know, less dramatic than an explosion, but can be just as disabling.
Talking to Rachel Rederer about her new piece, the cover story at Harper's Magazine, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. You can call in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jeremy is with us in Appleton. Jeremy, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, yeah. Jeremy?
Well, she kind of set it up for me. One of the concerns that I've heard is this probability of a cascade event. So the crowding and this issue of a cloud of high-speed debris created by a damaged satellite or a collision could then hit other satellites, and then they would break apart and create even more debris. And this would basically cascade into an event that would destroy a large portion of the satellites in particular altitudes or particular belts, and essentially make space travel very difficult, because there'd almost be like a layer of garbage you'd have to pass through that would be very dangerous. What's her thoughts on that, or the probability of this cascade event occurring?
Interesting. Rachel, you just touched on that. Can you expand on that a little?
Yeah, that's such a good question. The people who really focus on this are absolutely concerned about that possibility. That that cascade event is known as the Kessler syndrome, and it's something that people have been thinking about for decades. And, you know, it's hard to put a numerical probability to it. It is something that people, it is a real concern. It's not something that is imminent, but it's certainly the way that debris could potentially snowball means that, you know, a few big collisions could trigger that cascade effect pretty quickly. The good news is that everybody who is operating in space has a very strong incentive to not let that happen. And so satellite operators, you know, are careful about avoiding collisions. And there are some startups in the works right now who are working on technologies that could clean up space debris, that could, you know, satellites that could go out into those busy orbital belts that are equipped with ways to grab some of the debris and take it out of orbit. But that said, of course, you know, it's much easier and preferable to stop something like that before it happens than try to clean it up afterwards, especially with something like that where like this where the cascade effect would be so strong.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rachel Reeder about the new race for military presence in Earth's orbit, lack of international agreement about how that should all work. You can read that as the cover story in Harper's Magazine, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Who should make the calls when it comes to what is up in Earth's orbit and what kind of military presence, what kind of military activity should and shouldn't be allowed up there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Harper's Magazine contributor Rachel Reeder, looking at the growing international presence in Earth's orbit and the military questions that come along with that. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. You know, I'm very concerned since the United States started its Space Force a few years ago that this is a clear militarization of space, and it causes some severe diplomatic problems for keeping space unmilitarized. And then I'm also interested in your guest commenting on who gets to choose who throws satellites up there. For instance, Elon Musk is in the process of throwing 1,200 satellites up there for communications, and he's already done more than 300. We can see these at night. They're just obnoxious. And he didn't ask me. He didn't ask you. Nobody asked anybody, it seems like. Who's in charge of who gets to pollute space?
Chris, two big questions. Thanks for that, Rachel. Let's start with the first one, Space Force and what it meant for the international diplomatic scene when it comes to orbit.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I do think that one of the things that I really realized while reporting this piece is that we talk about the militarization of space as if it's happening right now and as if it's brand new, when really militaries have been using space as a resource for a long time, and it doesn't get discussed very much. So it's not that the creation of Space Force is itself a huge change in the way that the U.S. military is actually using space to support its existing missions, but it is certainly from a public relations angle, it certainly came with a lot of hype, came with a lot of talking about U.S. maintaining its absolute supremacy in the realm of space. And I do think that creates some difficulties in international diplomacy, and it makes it harder to make the case that other nations should not engage in space war and space weaponry when the U.S. is doing so quite publicly itself. So it absolutely complicates that conversation.
And Chris also asked about who's the register of deeds for territory in orbit. If I want to put up a bunch of satellites, do I have to ask somebody where they can go?
Yes, so that is a really great question. You do have to register your satellite. The United Nations maintains a database of all the satellites that are orbiting the Earth, but you don't have to ask for permission to put the satellite into a certain orbital path. And that is actually something that as these useful orbital pathways become more and more congested, people are starting to talk about the possibility of establishing some sort of really traffic management system. I mean, if you think about, the way that we drive, we have lanes, we have traffic signals, we have ways for drivers to understand each other's behavior. And that's, obviously we know that that's so important. In space, once a satellite is registered, there aren't lanes in the orbital pathways. There aren't rules of the road about where they can go or how close they can get to one another.
Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. We're talking to Rachel Reeder about her piece on orbital conflict in Harper's Magazine. Before we go back to our callers, Rachel, I want to ask you about a nightmare scenario. I'm a country. I have a lot of satellites up there. All of a sudden, they start to go dark. And I have to ask, is this an accident? Is this a test cyber attack or physical attack? Or is it a real attack and it's a nuclear war is about to start or some sort of territorial invasion and they're trying to blind my military? And I've got about 2 seconds to decide. How big a concern is this?
I mean, it's a huge concern. And one of the things that a satellite expert told me that really stands in my mind is that when it stands out is when it comes to space, you can see who, you can see what, you can see where, you know, satellites, you can see them from space. I mean, you can see them in space from Earth, but you can't see why. You don't know why a satellite is doing a certain behavior unless you talk directly to whoever is operating that satellite. And so if there is some aggressive behavior, if two satellites were to collide, and there is a question as to why that happened, did one satellite lose control and it was a true accident, or was it an attack? Those questions are paramount, and that is really why the diplomacy element is, I really think its importance cannot be overstated, that there's a real limit to how much we can understand and inform correct decisions just by observing satellites. We really have to be able to speak to one another and have honest conversations about intentions of what is happening that we cannot see from Earth.
Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Ashland. David, hi.
Yes, I think the whole thing of Space Force in the wrong direction. We need cooperation. I also heard that some of the weather satellites were getting pretty old and needed replacing. Do you happen to know if they funded money for the replacements of these satellites, which are crucial with this global warming world?
David, thanks for the call. First, that second part first, briefly, Rachel, do you know about the, outdated weather satellites?
I don't know about that, actually. It's a great question. They're certainly important. I'm not sure what sort of plans for replacement there might be.
And to David's main point, cooperation sounds good in principle. What have been the obstacles to the kind of cooperation David was referencing and you were starting to touch on there too, Rachel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the main obstacles is simply that the major space powers, the US, China, Russia, and then several others as well, but those are certainly the big three. No one is in a hurry to limit their own options. And so, there has not really been an appetite for a new set of international agreements that might shift the focus cooperation and arms control.
We're losing you there, Rachel. I think we'll wrap it up at this point. Thanks a lot to Rachel Reeder from joining us from Harper's Magazine. You can read her new piece there, the cover story, Ad Astra, The Coming Battle Over Space. Do we have her back? Let's see. Rachel? Okay, there we go. You were breaking up there on us. I want to just take a minute to look at you. You write about the prospects for some cooperation, maybe not a formal treaty, but people from many of these countries were talking about getting together in a less formal way. Do you see hope there?
I do. Two projects that are so interesting are these, what are called manuals that are being developed. One is the Woomera manual and one is the Milimos manual. And both of those are projects being written by groups of international military experts and scholars who are coming together to create documents that really take a very close look at the space law and space practice that does exist. And what they're trying to do is take those sparse documents and really read them so closely, map those principles onto the behavior and incidents that we've seen in the past couple of decades of crowded space, and create a document that really lays out best practices for, you know, here is the distance that a satellite can come to another satellite before being seen as a threat, or really spelling it out in a way that hasn't been done before. And those two projects have been in the works for years. They're pretty close to completion. And so, yeah, I do have high hopes for those documents creating a way for militaries to have better conversations and to just generally provide clarity that has been lacking.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Rachel Reeder, a writer and Harper's Magazine contributor. We talked to her about her latest piece for the November issue, which looks at the lack of rules and organization around who gets to do what in space and what that could mean for international conflict. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at what's fueling the supply chain disruptions around the world and what it could take to fix them. And that may be a long time coming, it turns out. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.